Denver Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Is your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for Toronto Raptors fans still partying in Jurassic Park thinking they actually won the game. 940 ESPN, 940 ESPN, Fresno.com. Your 3-hour tour begins right now, 6 minutes, 10 seconds past the hour of 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. I'm the host of the program, Christopher Gabriel, delighted to be with you today. Joining me, as always, technical director, producer, hockey guy, Giants fan, Russ, keeping us moving in the right direction. Packed house today. Should be a great program. Also a chance for you to win a couple of vouchers for Oakland A's tickets that are going to be good for one of 5 days on the five different games, good for tickets on the plaza level of the Oakland Coliseum. We'll give you those a little bit later, but on the program today, 3:35, my buddy Anna Kagarikas, Anna Kags, from 95.7 The Game up in the Bay Area. We'll be talking some Warriors. We'll be talking Warriors in just a minute. 4:05, producer of Big Ten This Morning on Sirius XM, Tony Landry, will join me. We're talking a little bit of U.S. Open, and I'm sure we'll get into some of the stuff with the the Raptors fans last night. 4:35, anchor, reporter, KC24, CBS 47, Ms. Julia Lopez returns to the program today. We're going to be batting around Fresno State softball and baseball, maybe talk a little bit about sports rivalries as well. Top 5 at 5, as always. Bulldog of the Week, we've got one, at about 5:25. And then you did hear that the Women's World Cup started today. The United States took on Thailand in group action. Not really much of a contest. It's a little bit embarrassing, actually. The score that I saw was 13-0. I think that's a final. I hope it's a final for the sake of, any tourism in the future going to or from Thailand. I watched a little bit of this, and I mean, obviously, the United States women's team they're the defending World Cup champions, and they're certainly they're a global powerhouse. I mean, one of the two or three best teams in the world, and you would think at this level that every team getting there at least has some level of being able to do something. The girl who was the goalkeeper, I'm not making fun of them, you just felt badly for them. The goalkeeper for Thailand, I feel like maybe I could have done a better job, and maybe not. But it just, 13-0, I'm just seeing the final right now. It's the most in a game in men's or women's World Cup history. 13 goals. Yeah, the most, 10 second-half goals, most in a single half in men's or women's World Cup history. 7 different players scoring goals. 5 goals alone by Alex Morgan. That's just unbelievable. That's absolutely unbelievable. So, quite a performance by them. Joel Listman joining me from Minneapolis, my elite soccer guy. And then at 5:55, one more thing. Warriors win last night, 106-105. My goodness, where do we even begin to talk about this game? I guess we have to start with Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant comes out, and he, at first, when he was running, Russ, did you see the beginning of the game? Maybe I'm just imagining it, but it seemed like he wasn't limping, but it seemed like, it wasn't his normal stride. And I was thinking, he's probably favoring that just a little bit. But then he drains his first couple of threes, and you're thinking, well, he looks pretty good. And he looked pretty good on defense, and he took a couple of dives onto the floor in terms of going for a loose ball. So he looked pretty good out there. But what he did, and then he went down, he played a total of 12 minutes. And what he did last night, I don't know. A lot of folks have been comparing it to Willis Reed. I remember the game, and I mean, I do remember the game in 1970, Game 7, Madison Square Garden. It was the Lakers and the Knicks, and he comes out of the tunnel. You heard Tony and I talking about it the other day. And he makes a couple of shots, and he didn't really play much after that. I don't remember him playing at all, but that was all they needed. They blew the Lakers out, and that was all she wrote. But I felt like last night was an iconic moment for him in terms of what he did. And there have been so many people in the national media, and you read stories, and Charles Barkley and all the various people around the country just having one opinion or another about what KD should do or shouldn't do. And I think that he got cleared. Barkley blaming the Warriors for him going out there. I don't think a player of his caliber, the best player on the planet, and when the whole league is up and running, one of the two best players on the planet, one of the greatest players of all time, I just do not believe Joe Lacob and this organization, Steve Kerr and company, are going to put a guy out there and risk his entire career, potentially, to try and win one game. I don't think that he's out there unless the doctors, the training staff, everybody has signed off, and then they go to Kevin Durant, and he says, I'm feeling good to go. You know he wants to go. Charles Barkley came out and said, you should never leave it up to him. I don't think it was left up to him. I think it was initially left up to the doctors and the training staff, and they made a decision telling Steve Kerr and his staff, this is what's in play. He is good to go. We've done test after test after test. I mean, is there a chance that he's going to hurt himself again? Probably. Obviously, we saw. But there's a chance anybody's going to get injured on any night. Just the degree of possibility was up for him. And then you had the moment of the Raptors fans cheering him, getting injured. We'll talk about that in the next half hour as well, or the next hour with Tony Landry. I don't know what the hell that was. I don't know what they're thinking. I've spent a good deal of time over the years in Toronto. It is a wonderful city with wonderful people. And was their hunger to win a championship that deep that it obscured their ability to show some compassion for one of the greatest players to ever suit up in the National Basketball Association? It was just weak. Credit to the Raptors players for waving down their own fans. You saw Kyle Lowry, you saw Serge Ibaka, you saw several others. You certainly saw the Warriors doing it. There was their court-level shot of Kevin Durant sitting there, and you saw a couple of fans looking right at him, waving at him. What are they thinking? What are they thinking? I know you want to win the game. You want to win your first championship. I get that. But we're talking about a person here. And DeMarcus Cousins Boogie Cousins had a comment. We'll get to that later about what he said. He had a short answer for the Toronto fans. Then he had a much longer answer. And, of course, Steph lived there for a while, so Steph Curry had some as well. But great class shown by the Raptors players, on the bench who he had to walk out in front of, by Drake, by everybody. But this was a game that the Warriors, the Raptors made multiple runs at the Warriors. But unlike Game 4, the Warriors withstood every single one of them until the last couple of minutes. So what I put together for you is 79 seconds, let's call it 80, of the last 5 minutes and 13 seconds or so. This is pretty representative of what happened, and what you're going to hear right in the middle of it are the three key plays, the Klay Thompson 3, the Steph 3, and the Klay 3. Here we go.
Leonard for 3. Bang! Raptors lead. Leonard drives, pulls up, bangs it home. Draymond Green, left-handed, flips it up and in. 5 to shoot. Leonard's going to try another one. Puts it in! Kawhi Leonard, back-to-back 3. Leonard to the rim, pull-up jumper, got it! Kawhi Leonard taking over. Back to Curry. And a complete pass, Thompson. Thompson finds an opening, 3-point is up, it's good! Klay Thompson from downtown. Curry gets a look, fires away, ties the game! pushing it up. Van Vliet in pursuit. Iguodala back out to Green. Thompson, one fake, one dribble, one shot. Got it! Golden State retakes the lead.
Curry's got to get it over.
And just gets it off in time. Green stepped in the backcourt. A backcourt violation. Foul to give for Golden State. Want to get it into the hands of Kawhi Leonard. 6 seconds remaining. Leonard back up Van Vliet. Van Vliet kicks it out. Lowry. Lowry for the win. Won't go. And there'll be a game six in Oakland.
Yeah, it was that was it. You know, Kawhi Leonard took over. I mean, he took over that game in the fourth quarter, and you had to think that maybe this is it. Mark Jackson made a very curious comment. He said the champs look like they're about to quit. The champs didn't look like they were about to quit. The champs looked like they were about to have happened to them what had happened to them in previous games. And that was Toronto gets on a run. Kawhi Leonard starts going crazy, looking very Michael Jordan-like in the way he's taken over a game, and he's unstoppable. Didn't matter if he was 26 feet out beyond the arc or if he was doing a pull-up 10-footer in the lane. Didn't matter what he was doing. They couldn't stop him. And it really looked like that was going to be it. That was the run. They had stopped three other runs during the course of the game, one in that quarter and one in the third and one in the second, and they kept managing to maintain that lead. They just kept holding on to, you know, 6, 8, 10 points and so on. But the most curious thing for me, and I think it's been discussed by everyone today, was the Nick Nurse timeout. They're up 6, and he calls a timeout at about, I think it was about the 320 mark, somewhere in there. And his explanation is he felt his guys needed a rest. He didn't want to waste a possession, so he wanted to call timeout and give his guys a rest. Well, it's not coincidental. I don't believe in coincidence, but in the final 320, it was about 330, somewhere in there, after that timeout, the Warriors went on a 9-2 run. And I like Nick Nurse a lot, but I don't believe that he was thinking about giving him a rest. I think he was overcoaching. I really believe that he was overcoaching in that spot instead of just letting the flow of the game keep going. You've got the Warriors on the run. Don't you be the one to call timeout. He did. The Warriors gathered. The Warriors got it together. And the Warriors, they went on a 9-2 run, and that was that. You know, but this was something you just, you know, with Durant out, and with the reaction of the fans and everything that happened, you know that this team was already just jacked up. And I don't know what those 12 minutes did to them. You could see, obviously, we've watched the Warriors all year. This is a team that when Kevin Durant's out there in the half-court set, it's totally different. It's not just that you have the greatest player in the world on the court and he can score from anywhere on the court, but it's also a big body. It's a big body to deal with the physicality that Toronto brings to the table. And then on defense, it's a big body, and it's like he's a guy that can guard everybody. So with him out there, the entire game changes. Hopefully, going forward in his career, hopefully he gets back to close to, if not almost the same as he was, with a feared Achilles. Yeah, you're looking at about a year, close to a year. He's not going to get rushed back. And, of course, this brings up a whole other series of issues, but you cannot tell me that there's any question of the kind of battler, the kind of baller that Kevin Durant is. I don't think you're not going to hear Kevin Durant blame anybody for what happened last night. It's just unfortunate what happened. And you remember Tony D and I were talking about it on the program yesterday. Tony and I were saying that you don't know what you're going to get. I thought the Warriors were going to win. I thought it was going to be a double-digit win. But the point is they won. But as Tony said, you know, the fear is, are we going to watch Kevin Durant where he gets out there and suddenly within a couple of minutes he's limping back to the bench? And that was certainly a possibility. I don't know that any of us really thought we were going to see that happen. But, boy, you knew. When he was on the ground, I found myself thinking, is he just trying to collect himself? And then you saw him take his right hand and kind of motion guys over to help him. And that's when you knew. You knew it was serious, and you knew that he wasn't coming back in the game. How great was that game last night? You had the Warriors looking like they're holding on for dear life, and then what happens? Their championship medal finally shows up. Because it wasn't there in games 3 and 4 in Oracle Arena. It absolutely wasn't in play. I'm going to see if I can grab this email here from Christina. Let's see if I can find it. Why isn't it popping up? Oh, there it is. Durant should not have been put in, as clearly he was not fully healed. I wouldn't cheer his demise, but I don't care for the players on that team, so I'll always pull for their opponent. Well, thanks for the email. You can always email me, cgp@940espnfresno.com. It is easy to say, to be, and Christina, you're not the only person saying it, it's easy to say he shouldn't have been put in. But the problem that I have with all of this is you've got the group of fans saying, he's got to get back in there, he's got to get back in there, he's not showing enough heart, why is he just lollygagging out there, why isn't he on the bench, why is he wearing a black hoodie, why isn't he out there with his teammates, on and on and on and on. Then he gets back out there, and then he gets hurt again, and then you have another wave of fans saying, he shouldn't have been out there. And I think what happens is it's easy for us to say that because he got hurt. The only people who know where he was at in his recovery is everybody associated with the Warriors. They're the only ones. They're it. We can speculate all we want. I was hopeful that he was going to get back out there. There was no. I think we can all agree that he wasn't going to be 100%. None of us are doctors. Well, some of you maybe. But none of us are doctors treating Kevin Durant. None of us are doctors doing rehab with Kevin Durant. None of us are doctors looking at MRI results, except everybody on that team. I know that sounds a little bit pedestrian to say that, but the point is, it is entirely too easy for both sides of the fence to say, get out there, and then after the fact to say, well, he shouldn't have been out there. The fact is, he was out there. You know, Klay Thompson, I mean, he had that hamstring tighten up. He missed the game. And then, I mean, he got back out there. There were those who were saying they're rushing him back. He's been fine. And then we're talking about the severity of different injuries. We don't know. Was it just a severe calf strain? Was there something going on with his Achilles? I don't know. And neither do any of you. All I know is that what we saw last night was we saw a guy out there who, I don't think that he was going to go out there. These are guys who understand the risk when they're coming back from an injury. And I don't think he's going out there if a doctor says to him, listen, you're okay to play, but you are at a high risk of really blowing out your Achilles or really doing serious damage to your calf, to the calf muscle that's been in question here. Then we're talking about how does he balance the desire, the hunger to be with his teammates and to help his teammates win a game to get the series back home to Oakland. How do you balance that out with there's a chance I'm going to get hurt more? There's a chance that I could really do some serious damage here. And beyond this game, beyond this championship series, looking at his whole career, looking at free agency. Because a lot of things changed last night because of that injury. We're going to talk more about this with Anna Kagarakis coming up at 3:35. She is sports anchor and does some great work up on the game, up 95.7 up in the Bay Area. We'll talk a little bit about it with Tony Landry as well. Glad you are hanging out with us. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Coming up in about 8 minutes, Anna Kagarakis joins me from the Bay Area, 95.7 The Game. Other players, the NBA, high-level players who have suffered a torn Achilles. Boogie Cousins is one of them. Rudy Gay, Kobe Bryant, Dominique Wilkins, LaPhonso Ellis, Elton Brand, Chauncey Billups. What's most notable, and again, this is, you know, he had the MRI. I believe he went to New York. That's what I heard, getting another opinion or a more detailed opinion. You know, it always seems odd to me. It goes to New York, but there's so many hospitals and you know, the best equipment you can get in the Bay Area as well, but there must be a particular doctor there that the Warriors want him to see. But I think the most notable point about looking at players who have suffered torn Achilles is the days that they've had between games. You know, Boogie Cousins, 357 days between games coming off his injury. Kobe Bryant, it's easy to forget that he had the injury, 240 days. Rudy Gay, 273. Dominique Wilkins, 283. Last night, General Manager Bob Myers, you saw he was very emotional. You know, this is the thing about social media. You had people all over Twitter calling his emotion fake. I don't know where these folks come from. I don't know where they have an idea that they just know exactly how Bob Myers or Steve Kerr or Kevin Durant or any of them feel. I mean, you look at somebody, they're giving you what they've got in that moment. And, you know, I don't know how many different people I saw writing fake emotion, as in fake news. That's okay. Okay. I guess we are so cynical now that we don't believe much of anything. Nevertheless, he was very emotional at the podium during the postgame presser. He said he was cleared to play tonight. He said it's an Achilles injury. I don't know the extent of it. He'll have an MRI tomorrow. Prior to coming back, he went through 4 weeks with a medical team, and it was thorough, and it was experts and multiple MRIs and multiple doctors, and we felt good about the process. I'll just stop right there and just say, this is not some rinky-dink organization in some tiny country that nobody knows where it's at in Eastern Europe that has a 1950s X-ray machine and a couple of guys that passed a correspondence course saying, yeah, he's good to go. That's not what we're talking about here. Myers went on saying he was cleared to play tonight. That was a collaborative decision. I don't believe there's anybody to blame, but I understand in this world, and if you have to, you can blame me. I run our basketball operations department, and to tell you something about Kevin Durant loves to play basketball, and people that questioned whether he wanted to get back to this team were wrong. He's one of the most misunderstood people. He's a good teammate. He's a good person. It's not fair. I'm lucky to know him. And he went on from there, but that you get the idea. I mean, it was a very emotional night, and they were, you know, I mean, when you see a couple of guys, I think it was Andre Iguodala and Steph Curry taking him back, I mean, it was just a bad situation all the way around. And I, you know, as a fan, you, no matter who you're watching, I want to see teams performing at their best. I want to see Kawhi Leonard completely healthy. I don't want to see Pascal Siakam suddenly go out with an injury. I don't want to see Kyle Lowry suddenly go out with an injury. I don't want to see Clay back on the bench. I want to see teams at their best, at their healthiest. Yeah, they're going to be banged up this time of year. There's going to be guys nursing all kinds of things, and probably things that we don't necessarily hear or things they haven't necessarily talked about. But at this point, with, you know, a 7 or 8 game preseason, 82-game schedule, and then all the rounds of playoffs that these two teams have gone through, it is a grind. You know, late September, early October, and we're already approaching mid-May. It is a grind. So, to get another perspective on this, and one a lot closer to the Golden State Warriors, coming up, we will welcome my good friend Anna Kagarakis from 95.7 The Game up in the Bay Area. Glad you're with us. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
One of the fun things in our business is making friends and colleagues, different parts around the country. And one of my favorite people is up on 95.7 The Game, does a great job up there. She's a sports anchor. She works for NBC Sports Bay Area. She's a TV host, sideline reporter, film buff, cook. She does everything. Anna Kagarakis joins me. How are you, Anna?
I'm good. How are you, Christopher? How's everything there in Fresno?
Things are good. Things are a little warm. You have some family here, so you know how it gets down here. It gets a little sizzling.
We're actually pretty close to you guys. I think we're about 102 today. I know you guys usually top us definitely out there with the heat, but, man, we're feeling it today here in the Bay.
Yeah, it probably really feels excessive up there because, yeah, you never really get anything like that. Well, I'll tell you, you watched the game last night, and you and the whole gang up there. It got pretty hot in Toronto. There's so many different places that we can jump in. How about we just continue where I was at a moment ago, and that is talking about Kevin Durant. It's the obvious main narrative of last night. You had the one group of people on one side of the fence complaining that he hadn't got in fast enough. You have the other group now saying that they shouldn't have played him. You have Charles Barkley coming out and doing what he does, which is basically make a bold statement, even though he may not have any of the facts. The people that you talk to up there, how did they arrive at this decision to get KD back on the court last night?
Well, there's a lot of things that went into it, and I don't think we'll 100% fully know that because the Warriors are pretty good about kind of keeping things in-house and kind of keeping that information kind of to themselves. First off, it was a complete emotional roller coaster of a game last night, lots of ups and downs. But when it comes to Kevin Durant, it's been really weird how things have been kind of handled and the information that's been coming out because, we were led to believe at first that he might have been back for game 3 or 4 of the finals. So there's a lot of anticipation for that. And then as soon as we saw that, no, actually he's not going to be out, but hopefully for game 5 and game 6, we kept getting that promise of, okay, maybe this game, okay, maybe this game, but it didn't seem like it was working. Something was wrong. But in all honesty, so the latest thing that I just heard was that I believe it was Chris Haynes with Yahoo Sports was saying that he wasn't close to 100%. He was really pushing to get back. He was really ramping his rehab program in order to get back sooner because obviously this team was on the brink. And if anybody knows Kevin Durant, it's that he is a true competitor. He wants to win. He wants to be a part of this team. Anybody who comes out there and saying that he didn't want, he was just worrying about free agency, worrying about himself, all this stuff about whether or not it was just trying to prove that, this team needed him, I think that is complete garbage. In all honesty, he wanted to get back, and I think he pushed himself, and he got the clearance from the doctors. Everybody said he was fine. He felt fine. It just happened to, unfortunately, it happened that he got the injury at the wrong point. And I'm not sure how much of it was related to the previous calf injury. I'm sure it obviously is a lot. But they did say, Bob Myers did say that he did have a calf injury before. It wasn't something else. It was a calf injury. But, obviously with that area, I'm sure it had to have led to the Achilles.
And I want to pose one thing to you that I talked about a moment ago, and I want you to speak to this. I came out and said, let's be clear about something, and even though I haven't spoken to anybody in the Warriors medical group, there's not a chance on this planet or any other that the Warriors doctors and trainers allow him on that court if they didn't think that he was able to go.
100%. I mean, look at what happened with Klay Thompson just a few games ago. Game 3, they're saying he was probably about 80% ready to go. Klay was fighting to get back on the court. He was visibly upset that he could not go out there and play. I mean, the guy missed. That was his first game that he had missed in the playoffs. I mean, he is an Iron Man. But they said, no, we got to protect you from yourself. So, in all honesty, I don't believe the Warriors would have put him out there if they thought he would have gotten hurt again.
There's no question about it. I'm visiting with Anna Kagarakis, 95.7 The Game, up in the Bay Area. Let's talk about the game a little bit. We're going to get back to KD because there's obviously so many more chapters in this book that are about to be written going forward. The game last night, one of the things that really surprised me, and I'm sure it was a talking point up on your program earlier today, Anna, was the timeout, the Nick Nurse timeout. Mm-hmm. You've heard his explanation. I've heard it. I have to tell you, I really felt like he was overcoaching there because in that moment, if he thinks they're winded, the Warriors are almost guaranteed to take a timeout at some point. You've got a 6-point lead. What are you doing there? And, I mean, it's not a coincidence that the Warriors went on their end-of-game run after that timeout.
100%. I mean, that was just the weirdest decision that he made. You see his team rolling. You see Kawhi Leonard with 10 straight points. I mean, at honest to God truth, I thought at that point, okay, it's been a great season.
Yeah.
It looks like Kawhi Leonard completely took over this game. I just don't know how the Warriors could come back. But as soon as he took that timeout, I was assuming they're thinking, okay, you just cooled out a hot player at the moment here. And then I think the Warriors only had one timeout. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think they only had one timeout at that point. And they were trying to save it, but you basically gave the Warriors a chance to kind of gather themselves up and figure out how to stop that run, and they did. And then you got, what is it, three straight threes, nine straight points from the Splash Brothers.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, you made a great point talking about Kawhi Leonard. I mean, he took over the game like Michael Jordan used to take over games, or like we've seen LeBron, or you know, listen, guys on this team, on the Warriors, he owned that fourth quarter. And I had said earlier, Anna, but just before you came on, that the Warriors, what they did last night is what they didn't do in the previous game. They withstood every single run that the Raptors threw at them, but this was the one that broke their back. I was right there with you. They weren't quitting, like Mark Jackson said. They were simply getting worn down. And then the timeout comes, and new life, and boom, Clay, Steph, Clay, Lowry with a partially blocked shot after a little layup, and it's game over. So then we now see the team going back for a game six. What is the mood up in the Bay Area? What's the thought? Because I find it almost inconceivable that this team, even without KD Thursday night in what will be a madhouse, would lose three straight games on that court.
Yeah, this is the interesting thing with Oracle Arena. It is the final season at Oracle, or we fondly call Roracle. So I'm extremely happy that it's coming back here, because it was such a poor showing in game four. And it was just something that, you know, you don't want to go out on that note. And to finally get another chance and know that this will be the final game at Oracle, you kind of take a little bit of solace in that. I don't know. I can't see them losing three straight on their home court. But at the same time, this Raptors team is so good and their defense is so good. So I'm hoping that this team can muster enough to really get motivated, you know, win one for KD and get that motivation from the Toronto fans, because they were not happy with how the fans were treating, you know, how they were cheering when KD got hurt. So there's a lot of motivation behind that as well. But basically here in the Bay Area, everyone is just hoping they can muster out another win and bring it on Father's Day.
No, there's no question about it. We're talking with Anna Kagarakis from 95.7 The Game. You had a pretty good tweet talking about earlier, saying that he said, part of your tweet saying he should find some solace in that they couldn't have won tonight without him, now win it for him. And it's a great rallying cry. Let's talk about the Toronto fans just a little bit. I'm sure you've been there. I've been there. It's a great city. It's a great city with great people. And this Toronto team is really a bunch of good guys. It's a wonderful environment. I was stunned at that reaction initially. It changed, but that initial reaction, Anna, and then the court level shot and the fans behind the baseline waving at them. I was appalled, and I was glad to see that the Raptors players jumped in immediately and were just waving their fans off. Must have shocked you as well.
Oh, completely shocking. You have to give your props to Serge Ibaka, Danny Green, and Kyle Lowry for telling the fans, you know, hey, this is a guy that has worked his entire life at his craft. These athletes are humans. They're not just here for our entertainment. They are people, too, with feelings. They work extremely hard at what they do. And you see someone like Kevin Durant, who works so hard at what he does and how hard he worked to get back to that point. And to see him go down, you see his heartbreak. You see that pain physically and mentally that he's going through. And to have that reaction is heartbreaking. And we can't say this is the entire Toronto fan base. Of course not. But those fans, whether it's in Toronto, whether it's anywhere else, you know, in the NBA, I am appalled by that type of acting, you know, by how they acted that way, because you've got to realize that they are human beings too, and have respect for what they've done. And really, in all honesty, you want to be that team that beats the best at their best. And no matter what, even as you got to look at what's going on with Toronto, you have Kawhi Leonard, who's doing what he's doing on pretty much a bum leg right now. And he's working extremely hard. So the Warriors, they're hurt. Toronto's hurt. They're all fighting tooth and nail out there. So let's give the respect for where they deserve.
We were talking with Anna Kagarakis from 95.7 The Game. Follow me for a moment here. Let's say this was earlier in the series, and he is back, and then he gets injured like he did last night. He gets injured again, and the Warriors lose. I think emotionally it would be incredibly difficult for them to basically, you know, rally the troops and come back and win. What was different last night was he goes down, and you know that every one of those 18,400 people and the thousands across Canada figured it's game over, but they surged, they held on, and they won. I've got to believe that, you know, when you look at the game, it's 48 minutes, and 36 of those minutes they played without him. And there, we finally saw the Warriors that we know in the last 3 minutes and 38 seconds when they just did what they had to do. And then the great double team on Kawhi Leonard that forced the ball out of his hands. That was as key a play as any in that entire game. Do you get a sense that the team, even though Durant will not be there or won't be on the court with them, that they were able to get some juice from this and that will carry over?
Well, let's say this. If you've watched this team, you know one thing. One, right now, based on how the Raptors are playing, you'd be completely arrogant to say that this team is going to win no matter what. But if you've seen this team over the years and what they have done, you'd be a fool to say that this team can't come back from adversity. This team can't. If there's any team you believe in, it's the Warriors team. There's a saying that they've had from the We Believe areas, obviously, We Believe. And that's something I think that they're going to muster inside them. Whether or not it's going to be enough, we shall see when it comes to Thursday. But in all honesty, you got to see the whole strength in numbers that they're working on. You see someone like DeMarcus Cousins, who is supposed to be a healthy scratch, and he comes in, and all of a sudden, within 5 minutes, is a complete burst of energy. In all honesty, they wouldn't have won that game if it wasn't for that burst of energy from Boogie. So he was a huge part. When all of a sudden, in game 3 and 4, he just seemed to be more of a hindrance than a help. So this game, he was more like in game 2, where he actually was an important part of this unit and helped them get the win.
There's no question. There were times that I was just yelling at the TV when I'd see him bringing the ball up, and he'd bring it up in traffic, and he'd get doubled. It's like, what, please, what are you doing?
Exactly.
You know, Kevon Looney, obviously, he has a very high threshold for pain tolerance. It's remarkable to see him out there, reading that Andre Iguodala essentially said, you got to stop playing. You got to get to the bench. What is the word on Kevon Looney for game 6?
So Kevon Looney right now, obviously, he had to leave the last game because of the injury. I believe it's like the rib chest area is what they're calling it, the first costal fracture. It looks like he is really trying to get back. He said he should be able to play for game 6. I mean, they're going to be throwing whatever kind of pain meds they can at him because he is going to play. So it looks like it's nothing official yet, but he is pretty much on track to play for game 6.
And you mentioned Klay Thompson, and he seems, I don't know what percent he is back to being healthy, but I'll tell you, last night he looked like, I mean, at both ends of the court and in transition, he looked like the Klay that everybody knows.
Right. I mean, he was, 26 points, 27 points last night. He was, I think last I checked, he was around 90% is what I've heard. So he's almost back to his full self, and obviously the additional days of rest is really going to help getting treatment and everything. So I think you're going to get a full play sooner rather than later.
Yeah, Thompson and 7 for 13 from 3. Just it never seemed like he missed. All right, let's roll this back. Let's roll this back to Kevin Durant again. Now we're talking free agency. Free agency, of course, begins 6 p.m. in 19 days. And Anna, I mean, I think we all sort of, I don't know, I shouldn't say we all assumed, but a lot of us were under the assumption that he was going to go to the Knicks, or he was looking at the Clippers. I got to believe now he's looking at a long rehab if it is, in fact, any degree of tear of his Achilles. You know, does a team want to take that chance on him, number one? Number two, does he want to go with a whole new medical team and what have you that's going to monitor his rehab? Seems like this would, hopefully, he want to get him back to being healthy, but it seems like this may give him pause as to what he wants to do. What's your sense?
So there's a few different things I've been hearing around here. One of the big ones is that it looks like he might potentially opt in order to get the rehab here in the Bay Area to work with this staff as well. There is also the sentiment that I think it was Bobby Marks who had said that there are 3 teams that he had talked to who said they would no problem give him the max in order to bring him aboard. I believe it was, oh goodness, what was the number? I think it was like 100. If he were to sign, it's like 140 million, something like that. And then for the Warriors, he would actually get more money with the Warriors. But for him to sign with the Max. So I don't know who would give the money. Obviously, you could see a team like the Knicks and the Clippers who have already expressed interest, apparently. That has been what's been reported. The Nets are another team that I've heard about as well. So we could see teams like that who are interested because, look, in all honesty, you have Kevin Durant who would probably be out 1 year if it is the Achilles tear and he will need that rehab. It'll probably be 1 year that he'd be out, but then he'd be back. So you have a team, if you have a young team that's on the rise, it would be a great fit to have Kevin Durant on the team. Mind you, here in the Bay Area, I don't know if you saw the Nike story that came out over the weekend. There was a shirt that apparently Nike had released where it showed all the places that Kevin Durant had played all the way back in Maryland, going to OKC, you know, college, OKC, everything. And then all of a sudden you have Oakland and the very last stop is San Francisco. So does Nike know something that we don't know, or is that just a big mistake?
And really, when you look at this, Anna, we're talking with Anna Kagarakis, sports anchor up on 95.7 The Game. She does a lot of things for them and up in the Bay Area, does a great job. You know, when you look at this, I mean, if we get down to the most basic common denominator, the money's going to be there, whether it's the max money in Oakland where it's or in the Bay Area where it's going to be, as you said, a little bit more. They can pay him a little bit more than anybody else. Take the money aside, it's really going to be what team does he want to play with? I mean, that's kind of where we're at, are we not?
It is kind of like that. And by the way, I found the numbers here. It's 4 years, 164, the max with any other team. With the Warriors, 5 years, 221 max. It is, I think, where his state of mind is. Does he want to go to a team like New York, or he could be in the Big Apple, be in Madison Square Garden, and then still, have that, but then also deal with the media out there? Does he want to stay somewhere where he's comfortable with the Warriors? Is he comfortable with the Warriors? So there's so many question marks. In all honesty, nobody here knows what KD is thinking. Sometimes I don't even think KD has made that decision, in all honesty.
Will you be in the building? Will Anna Kags be in the building Thursday?
In the building? I will be. I'm attempting. We are working on that right now. It is a packed house right now at Oracle, so we are working on the media credentials as we speak.
You know, because we are, you know how this all works, obviously. There's different levels of priority for credentials and stuff, and normally we don't have any problems getting those. And for this time go around, especially at Oracle, because it's a smaller amount of press credentials are giving out, I felt like the guy from the NBA might as well have just laughed at me, you know, saying like, good luck. He did tell me that it would have been almost a slam dunk if Milwaukee would have been in the finals, but with Toronto, it was a whole different story. Is that kind of what you experienced?
It's been hit or miss with games right now because we also have such a big staff, because our radio station, 95.7 The Game, is actually the home of the Warriors. We air all the Warrior games and everything. So we have a big staff that works at all the games. So it's kind of been almost a little bit of a lottery getting tickets to these games. And it is the last game at Oracle, game in Oakland. And it's going to be a very sentimental night.
Is Lorenzo walking around going, don't you people know who I am?
All the time. Lo walks around like he owns the place, but he's got to be careful because he actually picked the Raptors a while back to win this. So a lot of people are not too happy with him at the moment, even though they still love him. They always do.
Of course. But, of course. You know. Listen, it's great to catch up with you. And, you know, I keep telling you this, next time you're down here, you know, the souvlaki's on me.
You got it. I'm going to try to come out Fresno Festival, so I'll try to come out to the Greek Festival this August as well.
Yeah, it's a great festival, as you well know. She is Anna Kagarakis. Give her a check out and follow her on Twitter, 95.7 The Game. Anna, always a great pleasure.
Fantastic talking, Christopher. Have a great day.
All right, you too. Anna Kagarakis, this is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Yeah, the whole business with max contracts in the NBA, it's set up for guys to get their money, but it's a system that is set up specifically so the team that a player is currently on and then he leaves, like Kevin Durant, becomes an unrestricted free agent in 19 days, just as so many others around the league will. It's set up so that the team that had your rights still has the ability to pay you the most. So it is an incentive. It's an incentive for the player to stay with the team. And Anna makes some great points. I think that Boy, Kevin Durant's got a tough call here. I mean, because I really don't think it's going to be the money. I think it's going to be, where does he want to play? Does he want to go to New York City? And I find it hard to believe that he'd go to the Brooklyn Nets before the New York Knicks and Madison Square Garden, but who knows? Clippers are in play. I don't really believe that he has any desire to go and play with LeBron and the Lakers. And it might not be a bad option for him to stay right where he's at, to stay with the people that he's been comfortable with for the last 3 years, the people who have really committed to him, and the fan base that loves him. We'll see what he does. See if he's on the bench on Thursday night as well. Coming up next, Tony Landry from SiriusXM. This is the CGP.
Studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two, CGP begins right now, 5 minutes 31 seconds past the hour of 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. Glad to have you aboard. Fun first hour, interesting talking Warriors. Talking with my old friend Anna Kagarakis from 95.7 The Game up in the Bay Area. So many different scenarios in play with what's going to happen going forward with Kevin Durant, and whether or not he'll take the max money, which will be more, from the Warriors, or whether he'll decide to go to the Knicks, the Nets, the I almost said the Cowboys. That would be interesting. He could possibly be a wide receiver or a tight end, or the Clippers. But I wonder, I haven't asked Tony Landry if he has an idea on what's happening with KD. We'll get to that coming up right now. Tony Landry, the producer of Big Ten This Morning, SiriusXM, joining me. How are you, my friend?
I'm well. I would also like to throw in my two cents on Kevin Durant, because if you work in media these last few days, that is what you're supposed to do. Is he going to sue the Warriors? Is he going to sign a max deal as a, okay, I will take your money because you might have torn my Achilles? Or is he going to go play for Rick Pitino's team in Greece? I got to be honest, I'm hoping for the latter.
Well, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? And, of course, as long as he could put up with the cigarette smoking, because Rick Pitino is very unhappy with that, trying to change the culture of an entire nation.
Rick.
I said that you marched on Atlanta. You are now telling me it was more of a saunter. Was it a saunter more because of the humidity, or just because you were kind of getting a different groove on being in the Southeast?
You know, I had never been to the great city of Atlanta, and for that matter, the state of Georgia. And I'll tell you what, I spent some time at the Lady Catherine's father's lake place, mm-hmm. Outside of Atlanta in Lawrenceville, Georgia. And Atlanta's kind of got their own vibe. That whole area, nobody really seems to be going anywhere too fast. You know, lunch will be between now and when you're done eating. So it was, it rained all weekend, which actually helped the humidity for yours truly, who is not a fan of the humid part of life. It actually helped out, and it made for a much more enjoyable Atlanta experience.
Well, Georgia's a state that I certainly have spent some time in with my mom from Savannah, and I've got a lot of family in the Atlanta metro area, and certainly some friends in the area as well. It does have its own vibe. It's a pretty good city. It gets a lot of negative publicity. Not really sure why. I mean, it's a better sports town than I think it gets credit for. It's probably a bigger college town just because of Georgia Tech and Georgia right up the road. Of course, the big question is, and you know what I'm going to ask, did you go to the varsity?
Not only did I go to the varsity, I documented evidence, and I will prove to you that I was at the varsity and had something even new to my cuisine stylings, a slaw dog.
Nice.
Which, somebody finally just took the time to put it on a menu, and there are drunk Midwesterners all over the place going, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I've been doing that at every family barbecue since 87. So
I think you and I did that one morning before the show.
Yeah, you know, that Fargo County Fair only comes around but once a year. So when it's there, make do with what you can.
That's what, you know. Yeah, we put aside the flavored coffee for a different beverage, get a slaw dog, and we're good to go for 3 hours. I can remember many of those mornings.
I think if we ever start a podcast, which we've never talked about doing until now, we should call it Slaw Dogs.
I'm down for that. That's another bell. That's Slaw Dogs. I think that would be it. That would, you know, we'd probably have to get somebody like Harvey Keitel involved. Is Harvey Keitel still alive? I think he is.
You know, we play a game on Big Ten this morning often because one of our hosts usually arises people from the dead. So I will have to bring up Harvey Keitel tomorrow in a game of Alive or Dead because, honestly, I have no idea.
Yeah, well,
I would assume with all of his work with Quentin Tarantino, he has passed.
No, and in fact, he has not. He just had his 80th birthday about 3 weeks ago. He is he's doing just fine living in Brooklyn, New York. So there you go.
We're pulling for you, Harvey.
Yeah.
Come on, bud.
Exactly right. U.S. Open's coming up, and you know, it's right up the road from here. If you want to join me, we'll just get in the car and we'll go. Tiger returns. What did he win by, about 15, 18 strokes when he had his big win there in, what, 2010, 2011, something like that?
Well, the huge win came in 2000 when he was the only player under par. The number jumps out to me as like 107 under par and everybody else was over par. I think
sounds
it was 14
right.
strokes. Which is still one of the lowest scores to par in a U.S. Open. It is one of the biggest margins of victory in a U.S. Open and major tournaments for all that matter. And it was – everybody now has the thirst and allure of old Tiger. You know, when you want him now in 2019 to do the stuff he did in the past and the oversized baggy pants and the big maroon
yes.
Nike polos. That was kind of his real, not coming out party, because the first Masters he won did that, but that was the first one everyone, wait a minute, we're watching something really special here, because he was dialing in putts from all over the place. He was, you know, his wedge game was spectacular. That was, when people say they want vintage Tiger, go spend some time on YouTube and pull up the 2000 U.S. Open highlights, because as big of a golf nerd as I am, I'll say I went even one further, and I watched a replay of it not long ago on the Golf Channel. And I tell you what, Christopher, it's something to behold, because you look at it, and it is pre-oversized driver heads. It's pre-titanium this and everything that the players that get to use now. There's just a guy beating the field. And it was something that you really just didn't see in golf, you know, since Jack and Arnie and, you know, a little bit of Seve, and it was really something special, and he gets to go back to that, the very same place at Pebble Beach, like you mentioned, right up the road from you, and he goes in at, I'm sure Las Vegas' favorite, 9-1, because there are going to be people that are going to, you know, the guy that bet, what was it, like $58,000 that won him $1.18 million or whatever, there's going to be so many of those bets that come out on his 9-1 money, and then I've made a living on your program, doubting, betting against.
Yeah.
And outright saying Tiger Woods will never do anything he never did before. But 9-1 seems awfully lofty for a guy who, if you've ever watched any kind of professional or PGA Tour or major championship golf, you know the USGA is going to have Pebble Beach as pristine and as difficult as humanly possible. So for a guy who seems to play in only the prestigious and big tournaments now, is going to have to go into the hardest venue on the United States side of life and have to pull off some really spectacular golf over the course of 4 days to be in contention.
There's no question about it. We're talking with Tony Landry, Big Ten This Morning producer on Sirius XM Channel 372. If you are such an avid golfer and you're a very good golfer, have you had a chance to play any of the links at Pebble Beach? Because it is spectacular. There's just no place in this country like it.
Yeah, I have not actually had that honor yet, just having not spent nearly as much time in that part of the country as I'd like. And it's one of those things where I know for a while it was a lottery draft where you'd show up in the morning, you'd get a ticket, and you'd wait, and then they'd go, okay, we'll take, you know, you 57 people, and then the rest of you go home for the day. So it's one of those things where I've had a number of friends that have gone to, you know, the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am and different stuff like that, and have seen and been on the course, but I have not gotten that opportunity yet. It's one of those things where I love to talk about golf. I love to play golf. I love watching golf. What I don't love is course fees that are probably, by the time you're tipping out a caddy, the, you know, beers and hot dogs at the turn is going to cost you about $1,000 just on a Saturday. When I was happy last week in Bowie, Maryland, to pay $28 to play 18 with a cart. So.
Well, I'm looking at the price here right now, and let's just pick one of them. Let's pick Spyglass Hill, and let's say you and Lady Catherine come out, and you are resort guests there. Your fee will be, it looks like it'll be $395, and then, let's see, the cart fee is $45 per person. The caddy fee, I'd be your caddy, of course, that's $95 per bag, plus there's a probably a tip involved. Rental clubs.
Mandatory tip of usually the, it's the cost of the caddy plus half.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll take all that. I'm told that you're good to your caddies. So, yeah, you're paying a little bit. You're paying a little coin, but I have a friend whose family lives in that area. I don't know if they still are, but a long time ago, and they would routinely golf there. I guess I don't know if there's members, they were members or what, but I was asked to join them, and I very, very respectfully and graciously declined for two reasons. One, no way that my golf skill was ever going to be ready for that course. And I guess two is sort of part of one, and that is that it just felt wrong that somebody like me would be, you know, my golf ability would be disrespecting that course. And so I just thought, no, you know what, maybe I'll just walk with you or I'll be in the cart. And that's when I learned even then that, well, no, there's going to be a fee if you're going to be out there. You're either going to play or you're not going to play. It's like, okay, I'm not going to play.
Well, that's the thing is a lot of these high, these high priced, really important venues in golf, all over the world, they don't, a lot of them wanted private country clubs. You're not just going to get the guy that just gets to walk up to, East Lake, where they play the Tour Championship every year right outside of Atlanta and just say, all right, give me 36 with a cart and you're going to shoot 400 on each side. You're not going to get that. You can go to St. Andrews and golf. But there's a fun story back home in my home state of North Dakota of a guy that, his dream golf trip over to Scotland, he went with four buddies and they get on first tee and his three buddies hit their first three tee shots and, they hit him in a couple of different directions. And the guy gets up and dreams to play St. Andrews. He hits his first tee shot about 30 feet. Caddy comes up, re-tees the ball up, hits another one about 30 feet in the other direction. The caddy goes, all right, don't do that again. Guy gets real nervous and he slices one into the, into the houses of the fescue, whatever, and the guy goes, thank you for visiting St. Andrews. Your friends will find you in the pro shop and you're done.
Wow.
That was a trip to St. Andrews. They just don't have time for people to come out and shoot 258 St. Andrews, So it's something you look at it where it's you get to watch it on TV and you get to see a lot of that stuff, but there's a reason handicaps in golf exist because when you show up and you're Christopher Gabriel out at the Fresno Bulldog Scramble, it's no big deal if you're up 45 handicap because you'll get on a cart with some guys that are better than you. But when you're going to play at courses that host some of the most prestigious golf tournaments of the year, they can't just have a guy out there, playing the balls he found on the driving range.
Well,
so.
You're absolutely right, Tony. You're absolutely right because I spent my time then that day at the clubhouse. There was a nice little restaurant there. There was some good beverages. And I was more than happy to hang out in there because I didn't feel that my skill level, which was minimal, was worthy of being on that course. And I would have held everybody up. Folks, we're visiting with Tony Landry, producer of Big Ten This Morning on Sirius XM. I'm curious about your read on a guy like Brooks Koepka. He certainly had some success here, to say the least. Is he able to win another one, or is it just are the odds just too great in terms of the pressure that will be on him to perform to that level again?
It would be easy just to say let's pick Brooks Koepka and get out of here because he'd be his third straight U.S. Open, be his third straight major championship, and he right now when it comes to golf tournaments is just pick him till it's not smart to pick him anymore because he has found a way to do all of the things that when you used to watch young Rory go, well, if he could putt, and that actually still exists now, he'd be the perfect player. Or if, you know, Phil Mickelson knew how to, you know, not hit driver on 17, he'd be the perfect player. Young Tiger Woods, if he could do this or do that. Brooks Koepka is kind of like somebody created him in a video game because he hits it farther than everybody. He putts as good as everybody, and his iron play is fantastic. And when you play at a U.S. Open, to be redundant, you have to hit it a long ways, you have to putt really well, and your irons have to work. So I believe if I looked it up, I saw that he was around 7 or 8 to 1, somewhere in that ballpark, to win the U.S. Open. And he's only slightly behind Dustin Johnson, who's always kind of the favorite at U.S. Opens. DJ could miss the first 6 months of the tour with a broken ankle, and his first tournament could be the U.S. Open. He'd go in as the favorite because Dustin Johnson and Phil Mickelson are always the guys like, well, they should have about 11 of these combined. But when it comes to Brooks Koepka, I mean, he's a hard guy to doubt right now because he does everything well, and he doesn't get in his own head about it. I honestly think that by the time it's all said and done, when Phil Mickelson is sitting on a couch somewhere doing an interview in his late 70s, he's going to go, I just couldn't figure out why it wouldn't happen for me at the U.S. Open. And Brooks Koepka isn't, you know, the babe in the woods going, well, I don't know what I'm doing, but I know I'm doing well. He's the guy that goes out there and just says, you know what? I trust my game, and I'm going to find a way to win. We talked about it before the PGA Championships a few weeks ago when he said, I really only have to beat 5 people. He knew those 5 people, and he beat those 5 people. He tried to give it away on Sunday on the back nine, but he goes into major tournaments with the mentality of, you know, we're playing the Las Vegas Open, and Bob Hope and Dean Martin are going to be in the 19th hole bar waiting for me. You know, he goes out, and he has fun with it, and he's also one of the best players in the world. So I'm not going to pick him when we do our picks here in a minute, but I tell you what, if he's not in my top three, something's wrong with me.
And there is something to be said, is there not, for the guy that says, I have 5 people to beat here, that's how I win this tournament, and he knows it, feels it, believes it, versus the guy that says it, but you know it's not organic, it's not part of him. It's like the team that expects to win versus the team that hopes to win.
You had a much more able and front row seat to watch the 80s and part of the 90s Celtics teams with Larry Bird on them.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite things growing up as a kid is when you found out how much trash Larry Bird talked that
Tons.
You just never knew about.
Yeah.
When he'd show up to, you know, the United Center and go, how many people are guarding me? Okay, I'll score 55. But you didn't know that because that's not who Larry Bird was. You don't know Brooks Koepka says a lot of those things because a lot of people don't watch golf until it's Sunday at Augusta or the U.S. Open is on Fox and everyone's laughing at the stupid sound effect every time the putt hits the hole. But if you go out and you listen to him, he says those kind of things, and then he goes and backs them up like Bird dropping 55 in people's faces. And it's really something truly special to watch because he doesn't do it in a, you know, over-the-top kind of rub your face in it kind of way. He does it in the kind of way where he means what he says, and then he has the skill and talent right now to back it up.
Yeah, there's no doubt. So we have gotten to that moment, the pick for the U.S. Open. We've both not gotten one right. We've both had top 10 finishes from our guy. You are the guest. You are the elite golf mind. Who do you like?
You know, I seem to think every year there's one name that comes to mind when it comes to big, you know, horses for courses is a term in golf. And I haven't even looked up to see if he makes sense of this course, but I know what he did last week, shooting 61 on Sunday. Almost, you know, he needed a birdie on 18 to shoot 59. I'm going to go with Rory McIlroy because his game seems to be coming together well, and it flies in the face of everything I said about needing to putt well at the U.S. Open because there never seems to be a guy that's, you know, 3 out of the 4 parts of his game are working perfectly, and he can hit it to 6 feet, and he's still 2 putts for par. But I'm going Rory McIlroy to win another U.S. Open.
I feel like I've learned a lot over the years I've known you about golf because I'm going to read to you the note that I made earlier in prepping for the program under you know, heading number one, subheading B, where it says, our picks, and in parentheses, I like Tiger Woods, but if Tony goes with Tiger, I'll take Rory McIlroy. How about that? So I will take Tiger. And you're going with Roy. But I, you know, I must be doing something better. I'm not going to say right, but better, the fact that I was kind of in the same groove as you were with Rory McIlroy.
You know, every day I sit and listen to two guys talk about Big Ten sports, and you think every once in a while some stuff just oozes inside of you, and you're not really sure why until all of a sudden you're talking about Charles Matthews blowing out his ACL and what it does for the Michigan backcourt. You're going, wait a minute, I didn't read anything about that. So I know where your head's at, yeah. And I will give you, I will pull back the curtain and say the person that when I told you about, you know, picks today and who I was thinking, the first name and the name I so badly always want to pick, and I think I've picked him about six times on your program, but it's Ricky Fowler.
Yes.
And I love Ricky Fowler, and he's America's sweetheart in the golf world. And I think there's a part of him that is, you know, remember the great clip on the sidelines of Steve Young yelling, I finally got the monkey off my back,
yeah,
winning a Super Bowl with the Niners. Everyone thought Ricky Fowler was cute after that Ryder Cup they won when he was the darling in the picture. Imagine the fun he is going to have when he finally gets a major championship so he can finally look at Spieth and Justin Thomas and all of his buddies and go, there, I did it. And if he wins, I will be more happy about that than if I get a pick right.
I want to see him. I want to see Ricky Fowler win one. Just, I've watched him in eight tournaments that I can think of, and I've never seen him smile. So I want to see the man happy just once. Just one time.
Yeah, it would be fun to see him happy, and it would be fun to see him, you know, get interviewed by somebody other than Jim Nantz with a rare grin on his face.
Hello, friends. One last thing for you. I talked a little bit earlier about this with Anna Kagarakis from 95.7, the game up in the Bay Area, but I really want to get your take on what was an unfortunate reaction from the Toronto fans. Glad to see that they changed their tune when he was leaving. There was certainly a pretty good, I don't know if you want to say it was a roar, but a very appreciative applause. There was a KD chant, but the initial reaction was just reprehensible.
Yeah, it's a weird thing in sports, because when guys do well, there's always the one team cheers, the one team boos, and that's just, you know, that's sports. It's been like that since we were strapping them up in leather helmets. But there's always that unwritten rule that when somebody goes down, it's, you know, put your hand over your heart during the national anthem kind of stuff. You just do it, you know. It's, no one really knows why. It's always been that way. But with this, it's a situation where it's a really ugly side of sports when you're actively cheering for somebody to be hurt, especially when it's a, you know, it's a generational player like Kevin Durant. Not to say that if, you know, Sean Livingston came off the bench and tore his Achilles, it would be all the more reason to cheer that he was hurt. But we're talking about a guy that is once in a generation to watch, and he clearly was injured. And let's really point out something else here. It wasn't in Boston. It wasn't at the Garden. This wasn't, you know, I don't know, let's pick other cities that usually tend to have terrible fan bases. This was Canada.
Yeah.
These are the people that are supposed to be, you know, there's a video floating around, and I think it was Jimmy Kimmel did it, where he asked, you know, Raptors fans to talk trash about the Warriors, and by the end they were like, oh, but they're a good team. I mean, not to make light of the situation, but they were actively cheering for when somebody was hurt in a nation that's the happiest place on earth. And Boogie Cousins came out, and there's a great video that SportsCenter, it's a clip of him saying, you know, they're actively cheering somebody hurt. We're not players at that point. We're people. And
yep,
they are cheering the injury.
Yep.
You know, there's a guy that I hope he's embarrassed that was in the was near Drake or something like that, but waving Kevin Durant off the floor,
yep,
and he couldn't look.
I zeroed in on that guy, the same guy. Yeah, that guy, I'm surprised somebody didn't make a meme out of him.
It really goes to show you that if Drake has to be the moral high ground in Toronto for basketball fans,
it's
really not a good sign. And it's a situation where you don't really need to give the Golden State Warriors any kind of ammunition or any kind of reason to liven their shooting ability up. Because if they go home to Oracle and find their shot again and they have to go to a Game 7 against an angry Warriors team that could put up 63s in a night,
yeah,
it's going to look real ugly if they're dancing all over your floor with their third and third out of four and four out of five?
Yeah.
Is that how this will work?
That's pretty much. So. Yeah, so there you go. That's three in a row, four out of five. Folks, he is Tony Landry, Sirius XM, Big Ten this morning. Tony, always a pleasure. You got you down for Rory McIlroy. I'm going with Tiger. We'll just see what happens.
I look forward to next Tuesday when we speak, and Matt Kuchar has won his first United States Open.
That's about what it'll be. Thank you, my friend.
Always a pleasure.
All right. Tony Landry, coming up, we're going to talk with Julia Lopez from KC24 and CBS 47. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
It's an old friends Tuesday. Anna Kagarakis joining us today. Of course, Tony Landry. And then one of my real good pals here, one of the really good sports minds in town, sports anchor reporter for KC24, CBS 47, Ms. Julia Lopez. It is great to see you again.
Thank you. I'm excited to be back.
Yeah. Well, you know, you got in the lobby here, we got the full floor to ceiling glass windows, and we have it's an 8-member security team that you came with today, which of course you need when you come here because people start showing up and it's like, where's Julia? So we, you know, you have your team and we have our own security team for you. We just try to, it doesn't happen when Bemis comes over. Scott comes over and he's like, is there anybody here? He's like, no, there's nobody here.
Well, people are afraid of him, so.
They are afraid of him.
Yeah.
I sat next to him at the Mountain West tournament and I was worried. I always kind of kept sort of at a 45 degree angle just to keep my eye on him.
Exactly. Yeah. Those what is he, Newport Beach kids?
Yeah,
they're tough.
Very, very troubling. now, let's get an announcement out of the way right off the bat, shall we?
Yeah. So my parents are celebrating their 36th anniversary today, and I think they're listening all the way in San Clemente, California. So
congratulations.
Happy anniversary to them. Yeah.
Absolutely. 36 years, God bless them. I think that's great. Yeah. I think that is absolutely great. so many things that you and I could talk about. You've been here longer than I have, and you know, you follow every sport like I do. Fresno State softball, they won the title in 1998. I was looking at some numbers today. And since that title, Julia, 19 of the 21 champions came from either the SEC, the Pac-12, or the Big 12. The other two were Michigan and Florida State. And before that, before Fresno State won, UCLA won 8 and Arizona won 5. So the power for a long time was on the West Coast. But obviously the Southeastern Conference with Florida, with Alabama, have gotten better. Oklahoma's got a great program. Mm-hmm. Do you see in the way we are watching recruiting play out now in this area for all the different sports, there's so many good coaches here. Linda Garza is certainly one of them. Do you see Fresno State being able to find their way back to being in that same echelon with the UCLAs?
Oh, I think so, because look who's playing on UCLA, Bubba Nichols. She comes from Merced, so it's, you know, Central Valley talent. It's just having to keep that talent here and, you know, building that. And I think getting Daniel Lung from Clovis, like one of the top, you know, pitchers in the state coming here was huge. So I think the talent's here and just got to build off that.
Yeah, you know, because it's what I've seen here. And I've not asked you this before, is you see this plethora of amazing coaches that, I mean, people who were remarkable in their own sport, like Natalie Benson, like Troy Steiner, Jonathan Winder for volleyball, and you add in people like, of course, Jeff Tedford and Justin Hudson, Linda Garza. There's so many terrific coaches here, and they bring success from their days as athletes, and they are transposing that onto their athletes, and it just seems like softball and baseball, I was going to say softball and baseball are the next sports to break back into it. We saw a little bit of that with baseball this year.
Oh, absolutely. And going back to, you know, Linda Garza, like, I just love her coaching style. You know, she's out there running the bases of the girls that are,
yeah,
you know, coming around third, and she's just a little spark plug. So, you know, I would play for someone like that, you know, someone who's passionate about the game and loves the game as much as you do. So.
Yeah, and you know, when she came here, I mean, it's not anything hidden. I mean, there were some people that didn't want to play for her. And you know what? That's on them, because everybody knows the kind of player that they are and the kind of coach that they mesh best with. Mm-hmm. And you know, she's been in studio here. She's a tough cookie. Mm-hmm. And I dig that. I like that style of coach. I want a coach. I always wanted a coach. You were an athlete. I always wanted a coach that got in my face.
Absolutely.
Because that, you know, that they have your best interests in mind, right?
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. And they push you, and they push you past your comfort zone. And if you can't take a little bit of criticism, then why are you in a sport? You know, like, I think criticism makes you a better person, like even beyond the field. So.
No, I'm with you. Of course, we're talking with a very familiar voice and face to all of you here in the Valley, Julia Lopez from KC24 and CBS 47. You know, I'll just throw some numbers up because I've got them all in front of me here. It's really remarkable what this softball program has done. I don't know if this is updated, but it doesn't really matter. 1,740 wins, 666 losses. I mean, that's ridiculous. The conference titles, 23 conference titles. All of the NCAA tournament appearances, you know, it seems like they are going to find their way back. Do you think that in the way kids are today, we'll call them kids, the recruits, the young adults, that with softball, you know, you look at the facilities in baseball around the country and how, and we talked about this the other day on my program, how the Southeast and the Southeastern Conference, the ACC, they are spending tens of millions of dollars that they're getting from college football playoff, BC, New Year's Six bowl games, and putting it into baseball. And those schools are putting it into softball as well. Do you see Fresno State having a more difficult time to find their way into finding that money to not build a new facility, but to renovate on facilities that at one point were outstanding, but they need a little more love?
Well, I love Margie Wright. Just the atmosphere there, I don't think you can find that anywhere in the United States. Just several of them, but I don't know about if it's all about just the facilities. I think it's about the environment and the fans and getting the fans. We always go back to this, getting the fans there, right, and really packing it in. And it's not about the facility. I was just at in Stanford, you know, and like they have a huge screen, and that would have been awesome, you know, to see over at Pete Biden. But at the same time, like, that's not going to give you wins.
Let's talk about baseball, because I thought that they could have beaten them. And there's a number of things. We've already sort of litigated this whole thing about what could have happened, what should have happened, and so on and so forth. We're all armchair managers. But what you saw, what I saw watching this baseball team was, I think, this year, a return to the national stage. And they showed very clearly that, yes, Stanford, depending upon the poll you were looking at, was ranked 2, 3, or 4. I think another poll had them at 5. And they went toe-to-toe for it. They outscored them 20-19 in those three games they played with them. They're set up for, I think, a very bright immediate future and long-term future, kind of getting back to where they were.
Yeah, no, they could have. They should have been to the Super Regional and facing Mississippi State. Yep. I think we all saw that if we watched the series. I thought they were better than Stanford. But there was just, you know, a couple mistakes or a couple just, I guess, decisions that, you know, could have gone either way. And, you know, you got to live with that. But, like, we're not, like you said, we're not in the dugout. We have no idea what's going on. And we don't know the players as well as, like, the coaches. So you got to trust what they, you know, believe in what they think is right at that time.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because listen, a player who is getting recruited by Stanford, and the coaches have said this, generally are not getting recruited by Fresno State. I mean, that's just, you know, maybe it's much more prevalent in football, and there's no question about that. Somebody who's getting recruited by Oklahoma he might get recruited by Fresno State. He's not going to Fresno State. It'd be nice to see more of that happen. But I think with baseball, I think a lot of it has to do with results and who where am I going to get a chance to get to the major leagues, and what kind of a schedule are we playing, and what kind of weather do we have? Are we playing a season where if I'm going to a Midwest school, I don't have the kind of luxury that you have playing at a West Coast school, and Mike Batesel has that going for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you look at just like the recent history, look how many guys are already in the bigs and who have been in the bigs, and the guys that are sticking right now, you know, it's pretty incredible to see the guys that are even getting drafted. Like, there were 9 3 years ago, 3 2 years ago, and then 8 guys this year that got drafted. So they're doing a good job over there producing talent. So.
There's no doubt. Talking with Julia Lopez, sports anchor, reporter at KC24, CBS 47, adorned in your Angels shirt, mm-hmm, underneath the jeans jacket. How are you feeling about Ohtani's return?
You got to, like, understand. I wish he was pitching. I wish he was pitching, but we got it.
Have you got over that? I mean, are you?
Yeah, of course. Like, yeah. I know, like, you can't rush injuries, you know. So, right. Recoveries.
I'm just checking. So I wanted to talk with you about rivalries. I don't know what your position is on rivalries, but here's a particular frustration for me is when I look at a rivalry that's gone on for 50, 60, 70 years. I don't care if it's Alabama-Tennessee. I mentioned that because Alabama's had the upper hand on that. Or USC-UCLA, USC-Notre Dame, Washington-Washington State. Any rivalry you pick, Colorado State-Wyoming, one team or the other has a run where they win 6 or 8 or 10 in a row, or they go undefeated in a certain amount of those games. And a lot of the fans like to say, it's not a rivalry anymore. And I dispute that, because a rivalry is built on decades of quote-unquote hatred and wins and losses and wins and losses in recruiting battles, fans going to the other team's stadium and getting those fans annoyed, and the coaches have their frustrations. I don't know that, you know, that a rivalry just ends because one team is beating the other one. I've never bought into that. I'm just curious where you're at with that.
I agree. It runs deeper than that. It runs a lot deeper. And I feel like the biggest rivalry for Colorado State was CU, the Rocky Mountain Showdown, every year. And it doesn't matter if CSU's down or, you know, CU's having the most incredible season. Like, we're still, like, loading up that stadium, and it gets fiery. And the score could be 72-12, but, you know, it's still fun, and it's great for the fan bases just to, you know, have fun with each other. And it does, like, run deep.
Yeah, no, and I had a feeling that you thought that way, because I know that over the years, you know, like right now, San Jose State's been down in different sports. But you talk to people, I talk to people, you do too, who played at Fresno State, and they get charged up when San Jose State, when the blue and gold's coming in here. I know, as somebody who went to SC, I mean, there's been long spans of time when Notre Dame would win 8 or 9 games in a row. That rivalry goes back to 1927, 28. It doesn't just go away because one team's beating the other one. I don't know why. I think that's more of a fan thing, because it's not a player's thing. It's definitely not a coach's thing. Coaches always will remind their players, hey, this goes back way before you were born, way before I was born.
Exactly, and I'm sure Tedford has that conversation with his, you know, players inside. You know, I don't think you really have to go that far back with the rivalry with that, but he just has to let them know, like, hey, this is the pride of the Valley, and then, you know, it's all about pride at the end of the day. Like, you don't want to lose neighbor.
Exactly. No, yeah. It's exactly right. I know it's early, but it's not really that early. I mean, Fresno State football is kind of creeping around, and it's kind of finding its way back. I'm trying to get a line, kind of a handle on what kind of year they're going to have. And a lot of it's really no Jeff Allison and no Marcus McMarion. And I'll just throw this on the table for you. I think that my guy Jorge is going to do a lot better than people think. Here's a guy who's got a gun for – I mean, he's got a cannon for an arm. He can make every throw. Anybody on that team will tell you, spring practice last year, he was right there with Marcus McMarion. He made all the throws. He's got great legs. I don't know what kind of breakaway speed he has, but he's got enough speed and enough elusiveness and enough strength to just, you know, he'll go after somebody. So I think they're going to be in good hands, but I think we're going to find a lot out. USC is not the USC of old. I think they're going to be better than they were last year. It's a good test. I wish this team would have. I'm talking about, you know, my alma mater, but I wish this team would have played SC last year, because I'm sure they would have beaten them. I'm not so sure. Where are you at right now? We're still, you know, a month and a half away or so.
Yeah, we, like, a lot of people that I talk to ask about Jorge Reyna. They're like, "What do you think of him? Do you think he's going to do, you know, a good job?" And honestly, you have Jeff Tedford as your quarterback coach, and he can make, you know, you look fantastic and, like, run things that fit your style. And like you said, his arm is incredible. And, like, the first time that he actually threw a pass, it was a touchdown. What game was that? It was a home game.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
It was. I'm trying to remember which game it was, because, you know, up in the press box, it's always hip, hip Jorge.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit of that. But he, the thing about Jorge and what I've noticed, I haven't, now, I don't get to get out there as much as you do, but you could speak to this. He definitely has the respect of his teammates. wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think the guys, like, understand what he's had to deal with. And, you know, he's been sitting behind learning. I think those 2 years have been so crucial for him to learn this type of offense. And now he's soaking it in, and now he gets to shine and show it.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because it would have been easy for we see this all the time in college football at every level, whether it's a Power 5 school or a Group of 5 school, where a guy is sitting and – a guy just says, you know what, I don't want to sit. And they bolt, and sometimes it works out, and, you know, sometimes it doesn't work out. I love the story of the guy that says, I'm going to hang out, I'm going to learn, I'm going to learn everything I can, and if my time in the sun is 1 year, I'm going to make it a great year, and it's going to be individual, but it's going to be a team victory for us.
Absolutely, and I respect Jorge for staying. Like, immediately when they brought in McMerrion, he knew what was going to happen with him.
No question.
So, and also Chase and Virgil. Like, Jorge could have left, but he knows how important Tedford's, you know, coaching style is, and having that, you can't find that quarterback coach anywhere.
What are you working on right now? Because I mean, I know that you have your off days, but I know you always have other little projects and things going on, and people you're talking to, and so on. Anything new and exciting going on?
Well, this week I am going to be putting together something on Jay Carroll, just a little piece on the Sanger pitcher who got drafted by the Indians. He'll likely be coming back to Fresno State, and, you know, getting those 3 years in and developing, because he's a 6'3 left-handed pitcher. He's going to be wanted, but has to go through, I think, just a few years under some good coaching and develop, and he could be, you know, top 10 round pick out of there. So
we have a couple more minutes here. We're coming on summer. Now, summer affects us in radio a little bit more than it affects you, but it still affects all of us because, you know, in the fall, you've got football starting up, and then suddenly hockey and basketball are there. And, you know, I mean, we've got NFL, college. I mean, there's so many things going on. I mean, the wrestling is coming in, and just one thing after another. Summer comes along, and, you know, I'm ready to start featuring guys who are doing the World Bog Snorkeling Championships in England. So how much difficult is it for – more difficult is it for you and Scott and Andrew and the gang – to come up with features, or is there just a never-ending, you know, evergreen pile of things that you guys could be talking about?
Yeah, I think it just depends on how creative you want to be, and there's definitely some stories that we have in the arsenal, and, you know, things that we write down and say, hey, we're going to do this week. Scott is actually at a swim – he's covering something with Clovis West Swimming, so he's going to be doing that, and you can see that at 6 o'clock tonight, but with Andrew. And, yeah, there's just always – stories to be told. And you have, you know, minor league baseball, you have the Rawhide, you have the Grizzlies, you know, you have all this stuff that we can cover.
We had Jill Guerin in here. She was great. She is.
How is she? I haven't met her yet.
She's wonderful. Yeah. I love that, you know, she went to school. She's a Newport Beach girl. She went, Newport Beach. She went out to Emerson. She landed a job at being the communications director and then the play-by-play voice for the Rawhide. She came in here. She's all over it. And I think she has a great career ahead of her.
I love that. Yeah. I love how the Rawhide's giving her a shot.
It's fantastic. And the fact that when she got her job, I think the number was she was one, at the time, one of only three. Now it's one of six women who are doing play-by-play for out of, the, I think, 160 or so minor league teams. That's a tremendous accomplishment. And for young girls, it's a great thing to see. Just like looking at people like yourself and people like Anna Kagarakis, that sports, to me, is about, do you know your stuff and do you have a passion for it? It doesn't make a difference if you're a man or a woman.
Absolutely. And there's some guys like that have never played a sport in their life,
right,
and they can still talk about it.
Heck yeah. Heck yeah. Lastly, my friends at ESPN Albuquerque, 101.7 The Team, they told me for the longest time that, you know, you've told me about the tortillas and how good they are.
And the green chili.
Okay, and the green chili. Well, they didn't send me the green chili, but they did bring me, when I was in Las Vegas, they did bring me, one of their guys there brought me the cinnamon rolls. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I mean, he brought, and there was a big pack of, I think, like 6 or 9 of them, and they did not last long. You never told me about those.
I think I did.
Yeah,
I did,
you sure?
Tell you. I promise you I did. Because that's the number one thing. It's all about the cinnamon rolls.
I think you kept it from me. I was going to say, I think you kept it from me.
I'm telling you. And I haven't been back in years to Albuquerque, but I need to go back for the Balloon Fiesta.
Wait a minute. You're from there. How can you not have been back for years?
My parents don't live there anymore.
I
know, a bunch
but
of my friends have moved. And, you know, it's hard to get back, especially in this industry.
Yeah,
October's the time to go visit Albuquerque for the Balloon Fiesta.
Yeah, I've been to that.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
And that's when you get the cinnamon roll. When you have to wake up at 3:30 in the morning, you go there at 5 a.m., you got your coffee, cinnamon roll, and then breakfast burrito, you're
set. Should me, you, and Bemis just get in the car and go there?
Yeah, I would be down.
Exactly. I think we're good. Yeah, we'll just let him drive. And we'll
no, you don't want Scott to drive. I'll drive. Yeah.
She is Julia Lopez, sports anchor and reporter for KC24 at CBS 47. It's always great to have you aboard.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And definitely watch tonight, 6 o'clock. So.
Yeah, you should be watching anyway. Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Thanks, Julia.
Thanks.
Glad you're hanging out with us. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Just about a minute and a half or so. Close out this hour. Hour number three is on the way. Top five at five. CGP Bulldog of the Week. And then Joel Listman will talk about the Women's World Cup. We're also going to talk about the men's national team and just what is wrong with them. There's a lot of discussion going on in this building and certainly places that I've frequented, that Fresno State football, and how are they going to be this year? Because you look at some of the guys that they don't have, and right off the top, with Jeffrey Allison and Marcus McMarion, you know, there's questions. The schedule opens at USC and then Minnesota back here. Those are you know, Minnesota last year physically did a number on Fresno State. Obviously, this team will be much more ready, much more prepared in that area. And I think one advantage will be, even though I hate the heat, game time is going to be 7:30 p.m. that night, but they don't normally play in 100-degree heat, so that will be something that I think will work to Fresno State's advantage. But those first two games, we'll be talking about this a lot in the weeks to come, but those first two games are really going to be what set the tone for the rest of the season. No Boise State on the schedule. Utah State is on the schedule as well. Top five at five on the way. This is the CGP.
The Top 5 at 5 is sponsored by the Law Office of Josh Lazar and Associates. And now, from Fresno, California, to the furthest reaches of the galaxy, here are your Top 5 at 5 sports talkers of the day.
Top 5 at 5 for a Tuesday. Warm day. You heard Anna earlier, the game up in Oakland, saying that it's 102 up there today. Boy, it doesn't get like that up there very often. Top 5 at 5, 5 stories. Most of these, I think you've heard, but we have a chance, a little bit more time now to give a longer take, see what you think.
Number one.
We did talk about this earlier. Nick Nurse, Toronto Raptors head coach, calls a timeout with 3 minutes and 5 seconds remaining, and the Raptors were up 103-97. Kawhi Leonard had been dominating the fourth quarter. He had just scored. They just got 10 straight points from him. The place was going nuts, and it really looked like it was over. And as I mentioned earlier, it didn't seem. You know, Mark Jackson said the champs looked like they're ready to quit. They didn't look like they were ready to quit. It looked like Toronto was ready to take this game, just like they did games 3 and 4 back in Oracle Arena. But then he called timeout. And he said, and what he said later, he said, we just came across and just decided to give those guys a rest. We just thought we could use the extra energy push. And I'm just not buying that, nor do I think it was the right move on his part. I mean, he's an experienced guy. He knows the deal. But when you have a team that has just been down and you've now taken the lead, you are 3 minutes and 5 seconds from winning a championship and winning it for the first time, winning it for a whole nation, much less your own team, and your star player is showing why he is one of the two or three or four best players in the world, you don't take a timeout there. You just don't. You don't take a timeout there. And they take the timeout, and as we pointed out earlier, they came back on the court, and what happened after that? Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, three straight three-pointers. The lead goes from 103-97 Raptors, and we go to 106-103 Warriors. They get a little gimme layup, turns to 106-105. You have the Draymond backcourt. Final shot, Kyle Lowry gets partially blocked, doesn't even reach the basket, game over. But those 9 points in a row, I'm just imagining it, but when the Warriors came back out, those final 3 minutes, except for the blunder on Draymond's part, that's just a bad play that he doesn't normally make. But they looked like the Warriors that we've seen the past 4 years. You know, even the year that they gave up the 3-1 lead, they looked like the championship Warriors, where they came down and, you know, how many times we watched in this series where Steph wasn't quite on the mark. A little bit earlier in the series, before he got injured, Klay Thompson wasn't quite on the mark. Those early on, and then when it counted most, they were right there. And I just don't. He can say all he wants. He's a good coach, really good coach. He can say all he wants that he wanted to give his guys rest, but it was a bad move.
Number two.
Game seven for the St. Louis Blues and the Boston Bruins. That is going to be at the TD Garden in Boston tomorrow night. So you have fans in St. Louis that wanted to go to the watch party at the Enterprise Center, which seats 18,400. Tickets started to get distributed, and tickets sold out in 31 minutes. 31 minutes to be at the watch party at Enterprise Center. So the Blues announced a second watch party where fans can watch the game on a big video board. And that's going to be at the 46,000-seat Busch Stadium, which is, of course, the home for the St. Louis Cardinals. And tickets for that watch party went on sale this morning on the Cardinals' website. All the proceeds will benefit Cardinals Care and Blues for Kids charities, which is great. Blues sold out watch parties at Enterprise Center for the first three Stanley Cup games that were hosted by Boston. The excitement in St. Louis is palpable. Boy, you watched that game six the other night, and who knows what's going to happen tomorrow night. We had Dan Ruzanowski on. Dan thinks it's going to be an overtime game. I don't know if it is or isn't, but the game sevens tend to be, not always, but tend to be closer affairs. I feel like St. Louis missed their window by not winning. They got blown out in game six, but I think that they've missed their window, and I think this thing's going to go to Boston. Of course, I got pretty good in terms of predictions coming up to the final rounds, and then I've just been a disaster. So, you know, the Blues will probably go in there and win 8-0.
Number three.
Pat Shurmur on the New York Giants quarterback situation. It's an interesting situation. You'll recall Daniel Jones from Duke gets drafted in the first round by the Giants. Giants fans are out of their minds. Daniel Jones got trashed on social media. And you had Dave Gettleman, general manager of the Giants, coming out and saying, in 3 years we'll find out how crazy I am. The bottom line is I have confidence in what I do and who I am. I've been a part of organizations that had pretty good quarterbacks, Jim Kelly, John Elway, Kerry Collins, Eli Manning, Cam Newton. I've led a charmed life with the quarterbacks on the teams I've worked for. I know what good ones look like. The other thing is resumes matter. Every once in a while, I wish the people taking the shots would take a minute to look at my resume. I've been a part of teams that went to 7 Super Bowls. I had a hand in some of them. So what you're getting here from him is he's been reading the articles. He's been reading the articles, and he's been hearing what people have been saying about him on Twitter and about Facebook. Doesn't matter. I mean, you're the general manager of the New York Giants. It doesn't matter. But it is going to be interesting to see where this battle goes, because most New York Giants fans, well, I say most, the sentiment from New York Giants fans that I've talked to, and when you look at social media, and even when you've heard rumblings from inside that team, you've heard that a lot of folks thinking that Eli, his final days as a New York Giant should have happened already, but they're not. And reports coming out of workouts have been that he has outplayed Eli Manning, meaning Daniel Jones has outplayed Eli Manning pretty much from the get-go. So it won't be a surprise. I think Eli's going to get the start, assuming everybody stays healthy. I think Eli gets the start, but it's not going to be a surprise if we see another situation like we saw in Cleveland last year when Baker Mayfield came in and took over. But there's just nothing happens in New York, in New York sports, without controversy, even when there isn't controversy, which kind of brings me brings me back to Kevin Durant, thinking about him wanting to go to whether it's the Brooklyn Nets or the New York Knicks. And he's had his, we'll call it run-ins with the press out here or up in the Bay Area. And there's some great writers up there in the Bay Area as well as San Jose, the South Bay. But the aggressiveness, we'll just use that word, that comes at players in New York, San Francisco doesn't compare. It just doesn't compare, whether it's in the newspapers and the websites or it's in more specifically in sports talk radio there. I mean, it's pretty savage. So, yeah, no surprise here that the topic of discussion has been Eli Manning and Daniel Jones.
Number four.
Well, we talked about some of the comments earlier, and we can get into them a little bit more here now. Golden State Warriors not happy at all the way the fans at Scotiabank Arena in Toronto reacted to when Kevin Durant went down. You heard Tony Landry talk about the guy on the court. We had mentioned him in the first half hour, that when they had the court-level camera showing from Kevin Durant's left side, him just sort of sitting on the ground with his leg bent, and a couple of the fans, one in particular, just standing there waving at him. It's just ridiculous. DeMarcus Cousins was asked about the fans, and he said, bleep them. And then after that, he said, trash, so trash. And he really makes a great point here. He said, but like I said, we're idolized as superstar athletes, not human beings. It's always about what we can do between those lines on the court. That's it. That's all that ever matters. And then once we lash out and do human-type things, then we're considered bad guys. Klay Thompson, he said it was bleep. That was freaking ridiculous. I can't even put into words how mad I was about that. Draymond Green, that's crazy. It's classless. For me, I've always witnessed Canadians to be the nicest people I've ever encountered, and that was classless. Steph Curry went on the most about it, really put together a pretty well thought-out response, saying, I've lived here. I really enjoyed the people and their passion and excitement for not only the game, but just when you come into town, they just enjoy life and they're nice people. And he's right. I mean, it really is. It's a great town, and it really is very nice people. Clean town, too. Curry went on and said, very confused about that reaction. It's not my experience with the people of this city, and I commend, obviously, Danny Green and Kyle Lowry especially. I think they were the ones that were kind of signaling to the crowd, like, let's check ourselves a little bit and understand this is about an individual human being and not, shoot, he's out, he's hurt, we won the championship. Like, that was probably their initial thought, and you hate to see that when a guy's going through pain like that. Again, it's not my experience with this city, and I just hope that ugliness doesn't show itself again as we go forward in this series. Well, yeah, I mean, it's you certainly understand it, and I think, you know, if you're gonna try to find a way to excuse the fans that their initial reaction, I'm not. But I mean, if you're trying to be devil's advocate and find some way to excuse it, you can go down the road and say it was a compliment to Kevin Durant that, you know, they understood the significance and the magnitude of him being there and coming out and draining his first couple of threes, and then the fact that it looked like he was going out, which he was, they had this emotional release. But that's being devil's advocate. That's not what I'm saying. I think it was ridiculous the way they reacted. I've said it a couple of times on the program already today. And I'm sure that there's always going to be an element of fan or fans in every city for every team at every level that are going to react that way. That the sport, the moment, the team, the game is bigger for them than it should be. That it's suddenly the emotions of the moment get out of whack or out of balance with the reality of you've got a guy there who is the greatest player in the world, or one of two, if you want to go LeBron, one of the two greatest players in the world, and he is hurt. He is calling for people to help him off the court, and you're cheering him. That's ridiculous. And as most of these guys said, Draymond and Steph in particular said, that's not what people in Toronto are like. I've been there for Maple Leaf games. I was there for an entire four-game Yankees Blue Jays series, and that was not my experience. The two Maple Leaf games that I've been to at Old Maple Leaf Gardens and their new arena and the four Yankees Jays games just wasn't my experience there. So, you know, I doubt that would be the reality. If there's a game seven, well, it's not going to matter because Kevin's not going to be there.
Number five.
Well, Charles Barkley has weighed in. Charles Barkley said, I blame the Warriors for KD getting hurt, and I don't care what they say about it. They shouldn't have put him out there. He said, if Durant wanted to play, you can't leave that kind of a decision up to the player. And, yeah. Listen, you know that Charles is going to say something. I'm not surprised that he said that. And Charles speaks with the experience of a former NBA player, somebody who played in championships, didn't win one, but played in championships. And I think, again, I said this earlier in the program, it is really easy to be an armchair commentator, an armchair quarterback, an armchair broadcaster, and make that statement now after the fact. Charles is as close to the game as anybody, but he's not in the Warriors locker room. He's not on the Warriors medical team. He's not a part of that decision-making process. And if this to death, if Kevin Durant doesn't get injured, what Charles is talking about today is what a warrior, pardon the pun, what a warrior Kevin Durant is, what a competitor he is, what heart he has, and anybody who challenged that heart is just an imbecile for going down that road. Plenty of members, you know, you look around the country and you read things around the country, plenty of folks did that. It's easy to go that route after the fact. You know, I'd be interested in knowing, because I don't know what he said before the game, be interested in knowing if he was saying that before the game. You know, Warriors should not be playing him. Should not be playing him. Again, if you heard Bob Myers' comments. Bob Myers, general manager of the Warriors, said, you want to blame anybody? Blame me. But Bob Myers didn't make a decision to send him out there. This was, and you heard Anna earlier talking about it, and it's very well documented that this was a decision that was a group, very much a group decision. It was team doctor. It was the trainers, coaching staff, Kevin Durant. Of course Kevin Durant wants to play, but again, the good parallel is when the game that Klay Thompson missed and he said he insisted he could go and they kept him out. They're not, a guy who they had a chance, still had a chance to keep on the Warriors before last night's what we think is an Achilles injury, before that, he's a guy that they still believed had a chance to keep. And that Joe Lacob was going to sit down with, along with his agent and along with Bob Myers, and probably some of the guys on the team. And he's a guy that they wanted to make every effort to give the max contract to keep a Golden State Warrior. They're not going to do something that's going to put that or the rest of his career in jeopardy. It's unfortunate that it happened. It's terrible that it happened. But Charles Barkley, who I like a whole bunch, I think he's just off base. I think he's just flat out wrong in saying, I blame the Warriors for KD getting hurt. I don't care what they say about it. Well, you know, I'm sure that they don't care what he thinks or what anybody else thinks. But I think Charles is wrong. Charles doesn't have enough inside information because Charles isn't inside the Warriors locker room. Top five at five. Bulldog of the Week every Tuesday at about 5:25, or they're about just about 5:25 right now. And, you know, there's not a lot going on right now, the Bulldogs, with anybody in college sports, but there's always something going on. And we decided to go back to the Fresno State baseball team, and we made our CGP Bulldog of the Week selection A guy who was picked number 27 in the first round of the Major League Baseball draft by the Chicago Cubs, Mr. Ryan Jensen, right-hander out of Salinas. And we think it's very deserving of him. This is a guy who was the 2019 Mountain West Pitcher of the Year, Mountain West Championship Tournament MVP. He became the sixth first-round selection under Mike Batesole. And what a career that he had. I pulled up his numbers today, and you look at in 2017, 2018, 2019, he started 27 games. He went 17-7 with a 4.40 ERA, pitched 211 innings, 208 strikeouts. And this is a guy, just a model of consistency since he got here. And of course, this year. Now, this year, again, the first team All-Mountain West selection. I mentioned Mountain West Pitcher of the Year, Mountain West Tournament MVP, second team Collegiate Baseball Newspaper All-American. And that's just really good stuff. Good guy, and pitched great in the regional. You wish that he would have been able to pitch a little bit more. I was looking at the list of Fresno State players that have been drafted by the Chicago Cubs. And there's about a dozen of them or so. And I think immediately had some friends of mine who are Cubs fans asking about him. I think they're going to really like Ryan Jensen. I mean, the last 2 months or so of the season, I mean, how dominant was Ryan Jensen? My goodness. Last two-plus months or so, he was 9-0 with a 2.32 ERA. It's a guy who had 77 strikeouts in 66 innings, only gave up 14 walks. I mean, this is a kid who he was a dominant force for this baseball team, and the Cubs really got a good one. So again, our CGP Bulldog of the Week, Ryan Jensen, round one, pick 27, the Chicago Cubs. We did mention, or you did hear it at the top of the hour, but we'll mention it here as well, and that is that the Oakland Raiders in what may be their final year in Oakland in the Coliseum. Unless the new stadium in Las Vegas isn't quite done yet, then they will play one more year there. But they have been selected for HBO's Hard Knocks. That's going to come out in August. Mark Davis, John Gruden, they did not want anything to do with this. They wanted nothing to do with this show, following anybody around. And the Oakland Raiders went ahead and tweeted out, everybody wants to be a Raider. Now they'll find out what it takes to become one. We'll see you in August. And, you know, Gruden said, who knows, maybe Hard Knocks will come and this will be awesome. You know, I don't know. I think it is what it is. You're under a microscope in so many different ways when you are a professional athlete, a professional coach. When obviously their cameras, you all know Hard Knocks. I mean, it's a fun show to watch. And yeah, there's going to be things that'll come out, I'm sure, that they don't want to come out, but it comes, it goes, it's done, and then that's that. But I think they had to be the clear choice this year to be featured on it. You know, you had him and Jay Gruden both going back and forth about which team should be featured, but I think they're pretty good. The other candidate this year were the 49ers, Giants, Lions, and Washington. And yeah, I mentioned that you had Jay Gruden, the Redskins, just saying, well, if they were smart, they'd go to Oakland. What an entertainment value that would be. Antonio Brown, John Gruden, Paul Gunther, Vontaze Burfict, Incognito. You'd be crazy not to go to Oakland. You could do us next year. Well, that may well happen. Coming up, we're going to talk soccer. We're going to talk the Women's World Cup as well as a little bit of the men's national team with my elite soccer mind, Joel Lissman, out in Minneapolis. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Final half hour, we'll also give away some vouchers, plaza-level vouchers, for the Oakland A's. The five different days in July and August that you can use those for. But we're talking soccer right now, and it is the Women's World Cup going on in France. U.S. women had, I guess you could say, it had a decent start. whenever we talk soccer on this program, there's only one person that I contact, and it's not Alessi Lalas or whatever his name is. He's Greek, and I should know it, but we go to Joel Listman. He is the smartest soccer guy I know, and I learn something every time he's on the program, and he is back. Mr. Listman, welcome to the program.
How are you doing, my friend?
Well, I'm doing great. It's good to connect with you. This seems like a perfect time to do it, does it not?
Well, to me, any time to talk soccer is the perfect time to get homie. But there just happens to be a major thing going on, so I'll take it.
I want to go backwards a little bit first. The United States are the defending Women's World Cup champions. And they've only won, if I have the numbers right here, they've only won one of the last four, even though they did win in 2015. I'm guessing, Joel, that this team's coming in wanting to reestablish with a back-to-back World Cup win that they are the dominant power in women's soccer.
Yeah, I mean, I think the women's national team, far and away, it was the gold standard. For many, many years, frankly, continues to be. I mean, they're the model by which all other international programs, that's what they aspire to, that's what they, you know, hold up, excuse me, to want to be. And so, you know, they are, and the thing about being a great team and inspiring other countries is it means you're inspiring other countries, and these countries are going to get good. And these countries are going to these older United States women's teams are going to inspire. They inspired young women around the world. And so these young women around the world grew up with Mia Hamm on their walls and Julie Foudy posters on their walls and Michelle Akers posters on their walls. And they said, I want to play like them. And they worked their butts off. And so the gap, like any good competition, the gap is closing. And so we start to see teams from around the world, Sweden, Germany, and of course they have to have the football organizations, the soccer organizations nationally to bankroll them, to support them, to give them the facilities to invest the time and money into them. So we're seeing the gap closing. And we've seen that over the last – I would say 10 years or so, the gap really narrowing. And, coming off that in their buildup to this Women's World Cup, the U.S., they struggled against some teams. They struggled against England. They struggled against France. Then you can argue that they were trying some things out. They were not maybe, they weren't playing their best 11 at a time. They were trying some, there's obviously some, ultimately they're all just excuses. But, I think going into the tournament, when everything is said and done, when all is on the line, you're going to see, you're absolutely right, this team wants to come in and not only beat teams, but not embarrass teams, but they want to tear the heart out of their opponent. They want to, just say, good effort. Thanks for coming. This is our trophy.
Yeah, I would say, to your point, that was very clear today. They really wasted no time whatsoever and had no feelings for Thailand winning 13-0. That's just absurd, Joel.
Yeah.
I've never heard of a score like that.
Yeah, I mean, well, and you can't let up. You can't, and I've been, the last half hour or so, I've been reading articles, and of course on social media, everyone going, why did they continue to celebrate their goals, and why did they have to score so many goals? You have to. It's the World Cup, and the first tiebreaker in any group is goal differential. So if you have a chance to rack up a plus 13 in your goal differential, that means that you have a lot of extra room to play with in these next two matches. So if something happens and the United States, draws with Sweden or something, and it comes down to points to determine who goes through to the next round, well, that plus 13 is going to look pretty darn good then.
Well, there's no question about it. Absolutely. Joel Listman, we're talking Women's World Cup. We'll talk about the men's national team only because I want to, not because, well, it's just, I don't even know why we talk about
it. They don't
anymore.
Deserve it.
No.
They haven't earned us talking about it.
No, no.
But we will talk about it.
Yeah, exactly right. This U.S. group, Thailand, Chile, Sweden, and the U.S., Sweden seems to be the competition. How does this group match up with the other groups? This doesn't look like it's the most difficult group. Group D with England and Japan looks like that would be tough. Also, France and Norway in Group A. Give me your thoughts on this.
Well, I mean, the thing is the United States Sweden will give them a game. Sweden has traditionally, put out very good sides, but the U.S. should have plenty of gas in the tank for when they go on. They should win this group. They should win it pretty, I don't want to say easily, but they should win it with a couple gears to spare. And then they should be able to go into the knockout stages. Then it's a toss up, and like we say in any sport, on any given day, a team can beat another team. Suddenly Alex Morgan's shot could go absolutely cold, and she couldn't. How it works.
Yep.
Suddenly, Kevin Durant can't, or Steph Curry can't hit the broadside of a barn for 10-20 minutes. It's just those things happen. But on all things being equal, the United States team should stroll through to deep into this tournament, and it's not until they face some of those teams you just mentioned that really you should see them have to step up their game. And then it's a matter of, are they able to step up their game? Are they able to break down the teams that actually are putting out some solid sides onto the pitch?
So how difficult is it? What kind of a job is it for Jill Ellis, head coach, understanding that, they probably have the goal differential in hand today, just by what, mm-hmm. what they did today. But I suspect that there's a degree of difficulty for her in so much as you've got several more games in group play and you want to be ready, you want your team to be sharp. You're probably going to, as you said, you're just going to kind of roll through this. But you don't want to take a chance of getting one of your best players injured, but you're walking mm-hmm. that fine line of not wanting them to be sitting and not being sharp as well. How does she do that?
Well, I think she's the kind of the coach that she's going to be smart. She's going to give one of the wonderful things about the United States and having a wealth of talent is having a deep bench. So you're going to be, she's going to be able to utilize some of these, some of the bench players to come on and have some squad rotation that should not affect the final product very much. But also, she's also the kind of coach that's going to come out every day in training going, great, you won 13-0. Fine. That means nothing now. We're back to square one. If we don't go out and not only win, but send a message to everybody, I would love to say that they're going, we're going to send a message to the world in every match, and we're going to send a message back to the United States, especially the United States men's team, as to why we should be paid the same with every match. I don't know that you can really coach that way, but she's going to come out and say, we need to let every other woman know in this tournament who the big dogs are. Who is, we have the bullseye on our back and we welcome it. And that's the kind of mentality that she will put and make sure that, we saw even when the United States was up 8-9-0, you still saw Alex Morgan tracking back and covering her defensive duties. You saw players still playing very aggressive soccer, which, as you know, from basketball and other sports, and we see it in football, the moment you try to play safe, that's when injuries happen.
Yeah, that's a great point. Joel Listman, the official soccer mind, elite soccer mind for this program, has been for years. Alex Morgan, is it safe to say that she is the leader on this team?
Well, I think she's a leader on this team. There's leaders, there's vocal leaders, and then there's leaders by attitude and by play. Alex Morgan, I think, has always been more someone who leads more with her play. I think you got, Megan Rapinoe is more the vocal leader, which is why she's wearing the captain's armband.
Yeah.
She's the one that's going to, she's not afraid to get into players' faces and say, step it up. Or also she's going to say, hey, great job. You're doing awesome. Keep it up. She's the vocal leader. Megan Rapinoe is really the heart and soul of this team and has been for a few years. But you have players like Alex Morgan, like I said, tracking back, even with the game well in hand. She inspires people with her play and with her craftiness, kind of like how Mia Hamm did years ago. Mia wasn't a very vocal player, but she was the kind of player that led with a steely determination that inspired the players around her.
And no Hope Solo this year, which for a lot of different reasons. I mean, she was a brilliant goalkeeper, but at the same time, there was stuff that came with her. They are keeping three goalkeepers, at least that's what I had read. Who is it Adriana, is it Ashlyn, or is it Alyssa who is the starter?
Well, that's the thing. You're talking about three goalkeepers, and this was the big question mark for the U.S. team going into this World Cup, is who is the number one? None of them have World Cup experience. None of them have, real big game, huge, everything on the line experience. So that's still a question mark. I think, I sort of feel like, Jill Ellis is going to rely on her senior players, on players like Julie Ertz in the defense, the defensive-minded players, to say, who do you feel most comfortable with back there? And maybe that changes on a game by game basis. I really think, once you get into the knockout rounds, though, you got to commit to one of these women and go with the woman who brought you to the dance. I just don't know who that is yet. All three of them are tremendous players, but they all have some weaknesses that jump out, and they're all three of them are prone to the occasional gaffe, the occasional error that might cause a goal scoring opportunity. And obviously you can get away with that against a team like Thailand, but go up against Germany, go up against Norway, Japan, you make a mistake in the back and those teams will make you pay.
We're talking with Joel Listman. We're talking about the Women's World Cup. We'll talk about the men's national team in just a moment. So who do you believe is the – I mentioned a few teams. There's certainly some other ones out there that have some solid personnel. Who do you believe are the two or three biggest threats to the United States?
Well, to me, it's been really fun to watch the rise of the English women's team. The Lionesses, they are a very exciting team. I think that they have a really good chance to go deep. And it's kind of the same heavy hitters. I think we'll see. Well, Canada, has a solid team again this year, and they hate being in the shadow of the United States. So I think, I think England, I think Canada, you can never discount the home country and see what France is able to put together. But I don't think we'll see any surprises this year from any teams. I think when we get to the knockout stages, when we get deep into this tournament, it's going to be the same big names that we've seen for the last several years, last couple cups.
So
it'll be Norway, it'll be Germany, it'll be Japan, it'll be Canada.
So the English players, that they're called the Lionesses.
Yeah, that's what they're going with.
All right. So what are the Americans have? The Eagles, the Flags. What do we have any name for the Americans?
Well, I mean the big supporters group for the U.S. team is the American Outlaws. So maybe they're just part of the Outlaw.
All right.
The three lines, the three lines on the shirt of England,
course,
on their crest. So the the men's team for many, many years has always been referred to as, you know, they've referred to them as the Brave Lions and the Brave, you know, that's like a quick hit reference thing that they'll put in headlines.
Because our men's national team, if I remember right, I think you told me this, their nickname has been the Failed Againers.
Yeah, they're the they go through nicknames like they go through head coaches. They're the non-starters.
Yes.
My favorite is that they're the it's like go meh.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's just right. Well, we're coming up with Joel. One more thing. We're going to talk about them next, but we will give you a chance to win some Oakland A's tickets right now. These are plaza level vouchers, so anywhere on the plaza you can sit. There's a pair of them, and these are good for any A's home game that is on either July 3rd, August 3rd and 4th, or August 24th and 25th. So a lot of variety for you. Those are they're not valid for. Thank you. Thank you for correcting me. So let me reverse that. Maybe I should have read them better next time. July 3rd, that makes sense because July 3rd is Halloween weekend. So July 3rd, August 3rd, 4th, August 24th, 25th, you can't use them for those days. So even more variety, you have plenty of times, plenty of home games for the A's at the Oakland Coliseum that you can use them for. We'll take caller number 4-844-940-3776, 844-940-3776 for a pair of A's vouchers good for pretty much any home game except for the five dates that I mentioned. One more thing is next. This is a CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
One more thing for you today. A very warm Tuesday afternoon in the Central Valley. Actually, all through Central Valley and Northern California. I heard it was 102 up in the Bay Area today. We are talking with our elite soccer mind, hailing from Minneapolis, Joel Listman. Joel, we're going to talk about the men's national team just because I feel like we have to. I don't know what it is with this team, this program. They can't seem to get it together. Different coaches, different players we hear. There's always some sort of controversy that we're hearing about. Someone's upset about something. And I wrote the other day, wouldn't it be nice if they had a national team that they could use as a model to be for them, to find a way to emulate that success? They don't have to look far for that. Where does it go wrong? Where has it gone wrong with this whole men's national program?
Well, that's a whole show's worth of discussion, really.
Are you available Monday?
Well, yeah, I am. Of course, I am. But the, I think a lot of it. I've been trying to think about how to succinctly put this, which is it's really difficult to do. I think that a lot of it has to do with our own idea of American exceptionalism, whether in anything, in sport, in any. But let's just keep it with sports. We have this idea that we should be the best at everything, and we have never been the best at soccer, and that's fine. But we've created a league. We've created the MLS, and for some reason, the U.S. Soccer Federation and the MLS has convinced themselves somehow with no evidence that the MLS is on par with the other bigger leagues in the world, the Bundesliga, the English Premier League, Serie A in Italy. They've somehow convinced themselves that the MLS is just as good. And it's just simply not. That's a blatant lie that they keep telling themselves to justify, to try to market. They're saying this to try to market it to get people to come out to the games. And I say this as someone who regularly attends MLS matches. But to say that this league is as good as these other leagues is a joke. Now, for some reason, we also have this idea in our head that the coach of the U.S. national team should be American. And that's a trap that a lot of countries fall into. They feel like the national team coach should be someone of that nationality. And we got around it with Jurgen Klinsmann because Jurgen Klinsmann was essentially, I believe he was a full-on American citizen. If not, he had lived in the U.S. for, you know, many, many, many years. So when they're looking to try to find that panacea, find that person who's going to fix this program, who do they go out and get? They go out and get a former player who is just above 500 coach in the MLS, but is a really great guy and gets what the U.S. is trying to do. What? That makes no sense. When you had Tata Martino, who was the coach of Atlanta in the MLS, but came to Atlanta from Barcelona, who was rumored to want the U.S. national team job. But U.S. was like, no, we're going with an American. So Tata Martino then goes on. He's coaching the Mexican national team now. And watch out for Mexico, because that is a man who knows how to get the best out of players. So we cannot get out of our own way. Just like I can't get these words out of my mouth, the U.S. national team can't get out of their own way.
We've got about 45 seconds left. You mentioned the coach of Mexico and knows how to get the most out of his players. Isn't that what we heard about Jurgen Klinsmann, that he was going to get the best out of his players and was going to take the United States men's team to another level? Got about 40 seconds.
And he did briefly, and he also – he had the mission to try to revitalize the entire U.S. national team program, how to do it from the ground up. But he was met with resistance every step of the way because they said, no, we're Americans. We know how to do this, instead of trusting a German who came up through the German system to great success. So it's the U.S. team, we think they'll keep telling you we're on our way up. We're still a long ways away.
He is Joel Listman, and you can see why I haven't come by for soccer. Nobody better. Joel, it's always a great pleasure. Love to your family, and we will talk during the World Cup for sure.
Absolutely. Back at you, my friend. Take care.
There you go. Joel Listman. My thanks to Joel for his usual outstanding work and just great people all the way around today. Anna Kagarakis, Tony Landry, Julia Lopez, my guy Russ doing his usual great job, and all of you folks, we will see you in 21 hours. Until then, you're on your own.